You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 27th, 2016, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
How is everyone this evening?
Good.
Hanging in?
Yeah, there. Really feeling good, actually.
I'm okay.
Just okay, Jay?
You know, I work very hard, Steve.
Yes, you do.
Yeah, for you. Yeah.
I think it's a vacation time. I fully realize,
JT.
I really need a vacation.
Well, we have Nexus coming up in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to tell you about, Steve.
That's not work at all.
That's when I'm planning my vacation. I'm just kidding. Yes, I am super excited about Nexus. I mean, you know what's funny? Like, we've been going to conferences for so long that conferences are like the place where I see all my old friends, right?
Right. We have an excellent interview coming up later in the show with Michael Whalen, who is a science fiction artist and happens to be a friend of ours. We're going to talk about the whole computers creating art thing. But first, Bob, you're going to give us a Forgotten Superheroes of Science. You haven't done one in a couple of weeks. You're a little behind.
Yes. This week, I'm talking about Annie Maunder, who was the first professional woman astronomer of Ireland. She and her husband had the Maunder Minimum named after them, a period of decades when sunspot activity was shockingly low and actually had an effect on Earth's climate. The story starts in the late 1800s, which is when she lived. And as you could imagine, it was quite backwards at that time in its attitude towards women. The Greenwich Observatory considered it an unusual experiment when it hired college-educated women, even when it entailed giving them jobs meant for teenage boys. Annie Maunder, who was then Annie Russell, joined the solar department and studied the sun, sunspots, and magnetic storms, and pretty much found her career. The department head was Walter Maunder, who wasn't as educated as his future wife. When they did get married, Annie had to quit because of the civil service ban. If you got married, you couldn't work, which just seems kind of silly. And yet she still collaborated with him for decades. She became an expert eclipse photographer and even designed her own camera, which beat out bigger ones at capturing the biggest corona streamer ever seen at that time during one of the eclipses that she traveled the world to see. That work and most of her work was published under her husband's name, as was required by all married female scientists, pretty much. Can you imagine that happening today? It's only in the past few decades that it was realized that a lot of this work was actually her work or a significant contribution by her. So together, both of them, they created the famous Maunder butterfly diagram, which showed how sunspots cluster at high latitudes early in the solar cycle and then migrate down to the equator later in the cycle. If you put a series of these images together, you could tell that it looks kind of like butterfly wings. It's quite pretty. They also show that Earth's magnetic storms happen in 27-day cycles and are caused by the sun's corona and not the face of the sun. And they also conclusively confirmed an earlier prediction that between 1645 to 1715, there was a dearth of sunspots. This was in the middle of what's called the Little Ice Age, when glaciers were actually on the move and the London River Thames was frozen over. So that was big. They did not actually make that prediction, but they confirmed it to such a degree that they actually named it after them. And I just love the alliteration, of course, the Maunder Minimum. And also they have a crater on the moon named after them, Maunder Crater, which sounds kind of cool. So remember Annie Maunder. Mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing magnetic flux tubes in convective zones.
By the way, Bob, it's Thames, not Thames, is the name of the river you were going for. But how cool would it be to have a crater on the moon named after you?
Oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah. There's enough of them.
Buy them.
Make
yeah,
one.
You know what? What's funny about that, Steve, is I would look at a crater on the moon as something that's going to last a very long time.
Oh, yeah.
And something that people were going to see all the time, too. It's cool.
Sure. My luck would be on the far side of the moon. That's okay. I take it.
Steve, if the rest of the universe, what was that from Dune? What does Paul say? What do you call the mouse shadow on the second moon, right? Was that what he said?
That was Usul.
Usul, right.
Yeah. That's where he got his siege name.
Yep.
Dune. Dune's a great, it's a great series of books.
It's tough.
Oh my God. Yep. One of the best.
And very skeptical. Very, very skeptical. I recommend it. All right. Evan, this is an interesting news item. This is one of those where at first I thought, this seems kind of bogus. Tell us about life beginning with a flash.
A flash and a bang and a burst of light. Yeah, that's right. It's according to new research from Northwestern Medicine. That's Northwestern University Medicine. A stunning explosion of zinc fireworks occurs when a human egg is activated by a sperm enzyme. And the researchers say also that the size of the sparks is a direct measure of the quality of the egg and its ability to develop into an embryo.
So size matters.
The size of this flash, size of the sparks matter. Yes, apparently they do. This is fascinating stuff because it's the first time that the zinc sparks have been documented in a human egg. The phenomena has been observed in other animals before, but not at the spark of human conception.
Evan, let me ask you a question. You like Mrs. Sparkle?
Damn! No, didn't see that coming.
Oh no, I don't understand.
That's okay, Kara.
Do we go tangent?
Simpsons.
Tell her.
Just say
from Simpsons. The Simpsons.
Why don't I get from that the then? I should at least get your Simpsons references.
Yes, you should.
Dishwasher. Mr. Sparkle. He's Mr. Sparkle.
Right. So. Homer calls them up and he's like,
he calls the factory.
Why are you using my, like, he's just,
why am I Mr. Sparkle?
Why? And they answer on like the other end of the phone, you like Mr. Sparkle?
It's funny even when you say it.
Now that's actually one of the two funnies. One of the two funnies I thought that would come up in this news item. We'll see if the other one emerges. If it doesn't by the end, I'll offer.
Okay.
Okay. So, as I was saying, this is the first time the zinc sparks have been documented in the human egg. And the study was published in the April 26th issue of Scientific Reports. Now, Teresa Woodruff, she's one of the study's two senior authors and an expert in ovarian biology and director of Northwestern Center for Reproductive Science. She said the following. This means if you can look at the zinc spark at the time of fertilization, you will know immediately which eggs are the good ones to transfer in vitro fertilization, or IVF. It's a way of sorting egg quality in a way that we've never been able to assess before. So it sounds like this is a great way for scientists to decide which eggs you're going to go with and which ones you aren't. And that saves a lot of time, money, grief, everything. So it's a pretty big a discovery by these scientists. The scientists activated the egg by injecting a sperm enzyme into the egg that triggers calcium to increase within the egg, and it therefore releases zinc from the egg, which I had not known about before. I had no idea of the calcium and zinc sort of phenomenon that occurs with fertilization. So that was fascinating. Now, do you know why? Here's a trivia question. Why did they use sperm enzyme as opposed to actual sperm in the experiment? Anyone know?
Because it's hard to tell when the sperm actually touches the egg.
Good guess, but no.
Don't you just like hear a knock? Hello?
Can I come in now?
Well, maybe it lasted longer.
Actual sperm is not permitted in human research under federal law.
That's what I was going to say. Next. Yeah.
What?
Which is, yeah, it seems archaic.
But there's so much of it.
Well, to clarify, Evan, the use of human sperm is not prohibited. It's the creation of a human embryo that is prohibited. The experiment can't include fertilizing an egg with a sperm because then you end up with an embryo. So that's where the restriction comes in.
Now, the scientists had only discovered the zinc spark with mice 5 years ago. And now it's in 5 years, they've gone all the way from first seeing it in mice. Now they're seeing it in the human eggs, and they say it's fascinating. So as the zinc is released from the egg, as I explained before, what causes the flash? What causes the spark? Well, it binds to small molecule probes, which emits light in fluorescence microscopy experiments. And they were able to see the spark using a new fluorescent sensor, able to track the movements of zinc in the live cells. And the team caught the glimpse of the egg zinc storage capabilities and found that some 8,000 zinc compartments, each one containing around 1 million zinc atoms, were just ripe for exploding. Wow. So the tiny fireworks that result were found to last also for about 2 hours after fertilization. That's quite a show. That's movie length we're talking about.
Ev, do you think this is a potential future source of light for humans?
No. I don't. It's not like you can read a book by it or something.
That gives new meaning to the term keep it up all night. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Oh, Jesus.
So let me emphasize a few things here, because a lot of the headlines say things like life begins with the flash. So first of all, as we just said, there's no life here. This is an enzyme, a fertilization enzyme. Fertilization did not actually occur. Second, as you said, Evan, these are fluorescent probes. This is not the embryo itself does not emit any light, and the zinc spark, you know, only sparks because the experimenters added molecules that fluoresce when zinc binds to them. Without those added probes, there would be no fluorescence. There would be no emission of light. And just as an aside, you didn't mention this, but the purpose of the release of zinc is part of a cascade that seals essentially the embryos so that multiple sperm will not fertilize it. Like once one sperm gets in, then there's a change in the membrane to block out any further sperm, and that zinc release is all part of that. And just one more caveat as well. So again, because this was simulated fertilization, we need to know if this occurs with actual fertilization and if that will, in a human, because it was seen in a mouse, and will that be a practical method? Could we practically apply that to evaluating embryos for in vitro fertilization? They need to do the next series of experiments. Hopefully they'll be able to do that with the embryo ban. I guess they could do it just as a sort of an observational study when they do actual in vitro fertilization.
So I suppose that'll be the next series of tests and studies to see if it holds true. But it sounds promising.
We'll have to see if it pans out. This is like that preliminary research stage where this suggests a possibility, but then they have to find out if it's actually real before we could talk about using this to predict which eggs are going to be the most fertile in vitro fertilization. So the phenomenon is interesting. The application, we're a couple of steps away from that. All right, Carrie, you have another similar item that is interesting, but maybe a little bit more preliminary than the headlines are indicating. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, a little overhyped here. So in yet another example of kind of blown out of proportion science reporting, no, plants do not have mad cow disease. And also, plants don't use prions to remember. But what actually happened, if you've been seeing these headlines, here's one from New Scientist, plants may form memories using mad cow disease proteins. What actually did happen is that for the first time ever, scientists have discovered a prion-like protein in a plant. So in order to kind of discuss what that means, I think we have to back up a bit and do a little mini primer on prions.
Primer!
First, I say prion. Oh, no!
It's a primer on prions.
Yes.
Oh, it's so funny. That's so where I was about to go. Oh my God. We talk so different, you and me. Yeah, well, it's so different. Weird. We were having this conversation before we started recording, and everybody's like, no, it's prion. And I was like, no, it's prion. And so we looked online, and it's totally both, depending
totally
on where
both.
You're from.
Yeah.
Right. So you'll hear me say prion throughout because that's much more comfortable for me. But the computer lady who read me one of the articles while I was driving via TTS, she kept saying prion, and it was driving me crazy. But here's a little background on them. Prions are fascinating, first of all. They are one of the only infectious agents that aren't actually alive, per se, other than, you know, you could argue that viruses are an infectious agent that isn't alive, but it is the only infectious agent that doesn't contain DNA or RNA. So
that's
prions
big.
Are
wow.
actually, yeah, it's huge. They're misfolded proteins, and they cause a class of diseases called the transmissible spongiform encephalopathies. So most famously, that's bovine spongiform encephalopathy or mad cow disease. That can happen when cows are actually fed contaminated meat and bone meal. In humans, you see often, you see it known as Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, among others. Yeah. This can happen from eating meat with mad cow, or it can even be passed down genetically, as is the case in about 5 to 10% of incidences. And most notably, you'll see these among the Jewish population. And prions are also famously the cause of kuru, which is a fascinating disease that struck a tribe in Papua New Guinea following ritualistic cannibalism. Don't eat brains.
Human brains.
Because if those human brains have prions, you could get them too. And what happens with prions is these misfolded proteins will actually kind of spark other proteins nearby to misfold as well. And you see this exponential, unfolding of these this exponential growth of these misfolded proteins. And eventually, when you look at, the histology, when you look at slides of brain tissue under the microscope, it looks like Swiss cheese. There's actual holes in the brain tissue and it causes a whole host of horrible symptoms. But it is a degenerative neurological condition that does lead to death. So it's pretty intense. But I digress, because what we're talking about now is prions in plants. Totally different animal. And although last year researchers from the UT Health Science Center in Texas found that plants can serve as a vector for prions, until now, prions have never been found to actually occur in plants. So here's what happened. Susan Lindquist and her colleagues at the Whitehead Institute in Cambridge, Mass, have been doing research on prions for many, many years. And they specifically focus on the role that prions play in yeast or other fungi. And they found compelling evidence that they may be beneficial to the organisms, like helping them adapt to their environment. Knowing the coding regions that are involved, because they've been studying prions in yeast for so long, they scanned the genome of Arabidopsis, also known as thalecress, which is a flowering plant, and it's a model organism you see in a lot of plant biology labs. They found that 3 out of the 4 coding regions that they got hits with were consistent behaviorally with the way that prions work. You know, there's the misfolded state and then the kind of the healthy, regular folded state. And they found that 3 out of 4 of these coding regions were consistent with a prion that can misfold. In the plants, the prion is called, this is a really fun word to try to pronounce, luminodependens. So we're going to call that LD for short. And LD usually responds to daylight, and it also controls flowering time. And when Lindquist and colleagues inserted the LD gene into yeast, it produced a protein that then misfolded and spread the misfolding exponentially, just like a prion. And even later generations could inherit the effect, and their versions of the protein misfolded as well. So it's a misnomer to say that prions were found in plants, but a prion-like protein was found in Arabidopsis, put into yeast, and it tended to do what prions have been known to do in both fungi and animals. So here's where things get speculative. And this is what bugs me about a lot of the science reporting around this, because it seems like the bulk of the articles are not about what was actually found, but they're about this.
Yeah.
Lindquist is not a plant biologist. She does not claim to know much about the plant genome. But here's a quote from an article in Nature that covered the findings that I think sums up quite beautifully where the bad reporting was. Not to say that this was actually poorly reported in Nature. I think that's one of the few articles that I found that were pretty solid. Quote, "So the same might be true in plants," she speculates. Lindquist says that a clue could come from work done by other researchers, which has suggested that in fruit flies, the buildup of prion-like proteins might help to form or stabilize long-term memories by creating long-lived protein clusters at synapses. That is a huge overreach.
Mm-hmm.
That is incredibly speculative. We have no idea what these proteins do or don't do when they're in this misfolded arrangement. We have no idea why plants might have evolved to have these proteins. We do know that in a healthy arrangement, they seem to have some control over responses to daylight and flowering time. And that's where the reach jumped, because it has been noted that in some plants, if like the climate has changed, if the patterns are off, they won't flower because it's, you know, colder at certain points of the year, warmer than it should be. And they'll kind of quote unquote remember what those seasonal cycles were and actually flower later or earlier, depending on past data. We know that that happens, but we don't know how or why. We also know that this gene tends to be involved in daylight recognition and flowering time control. And somehow now we're just making a wild speculative jump that a prion-like protein just discovered in a plant, and only discovered because we saw that it had prion-like activity in yeast, is somehow involved in plants making memories.
Right, which you have no... Yeah, that was the pure speculation.
This is pure speculation, and that's all most of the articles actually said. So keep that in mind when you're reading this. You know, if you can, go back to the source publication as often as you can, even if it's just about reading the abstract, you know, if you can't get access to full text articles, because most of them are behind paywalls. And also look at multiple sources that are reporting on the story, and you'll start to see that there are commonalities by different reporters, and then there are things that really stick out. And you know, put on your skeptical cap. I know it's a lot of work. That's why we try to do it for you guys a little bit and present these articles on the show. But if something especially sparks your interest, if it sounds too good to be true, if it sounds like, holy crap, this is a really new thing, it's a really big thing, read about it a little bit more than you would just superficially. And I think that oftentimes you'll find some things are overhyped. It is new, it is exciting, and it could launch a lot of interesting new research, but I think that the jury is still out, as often is the case, on what these proteins do, why these proteins are there, and you know, the story hasn't been told completely.
Yeah, that pattern is so common. Mm-hmm. So what you need to ask yourself is, what did the study actually show? What was the data? And not the speculation about what it might mean, because you're right, the reporting is often about the speculation and not about the actual data. So until I could really answer that question to my own satisfaction, I don't know what a study really showed, what it was about, you know?
Yeah. And so I think it's important to talk about what the study shows first. We can discuss where this might go, but we have to put it in that bucket. Yeah. And say, you know, this is the discussion section of the paper. This is the, why am I doing this? And what can we do in the future? And where can this go? But for now, that's why I really liked this Nature article. I got to give props to Anna Nowogrodzki, who wrote about the study, because she even really pointed out that multiple researchers say that this is wild speculation, and they completely disagree that this is something that we even have an inkling, right, you know, that we even remotely know about.
But prions are cool, and we are learning that misfolded proteins. So again, just for a little bit of background, in order for something to be a protein, a protein is a sequence of amino acids that is folded into a particular functional shape. If it's not folded up, it's just a polypeptide. It's just a string of amino acids. A protein is folded. This is an area of ignorance and research, you know, where we're trying to figure out, how do proteins know how to fold? There's the Protein Folding Project, right? It's like a fold proteins at home thing. It's one of those problems that it's hard for computers to brute force their way through, because it's just so complicated.
Yeah, it's got like multiple levels. You've got the primary and secondary, tertiary and quaternary. And then there's like the sheets and the whatevers, and there's all these different ways that they fold.
And so now we're finding that, yeah, proteins can fold in more than one way. And this is a disease when it folds in a way that destroys its functionality, like with mad cow disease or Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease.
And fascinatingly, it kind of like has this nucleation site that just like moves out from it. You have one misfolded protein, and all the ones nearby start to misfold as well.
It induces the conformation in the other proteins, which is cool. But we're also finding, like, for example, that Alzheimer's disease may be primarily a protein folding disorder.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah. That it's maybe this is,
as opposed to a plaque buildup.
Well, and then there's lots of things happening with Alzheimer's disease, but we're still trying to figure out what's driving it, as opposed to the effects of it. So this is just another thing that's happening that we're not sure what role it's actually playing. But that's an area of research right now, is what's the role of misfolded proteins in Alzheimer's disease. So it's more than just these rare, you know, prion diseases. It may have a role in neurodegenerative diseases as well. Very interesting. All right, let's move on. Mm-hmm. Have you guys heard about the Stephans, David and Colette Stephan?
The Canadian, this is blowing up our inbox.
Oh yeah.
A lot of people telling us about
and
this.
And I wrote
one
about it on Science Based Medicine today. It's a sad case, but you know, it's one in our chain of When Pseudoscience Kills kind of informal series. David and Colette Stephan are Canadians who, 4 years ago, their 19-month-old died from a bacterial meningitis. This is like a parent's worst nightmare, bacterial meningitis. I've seen cases of it. It's just horrible, because it could be very fulminant. You know, the bacteria grows out of control. You get this pus filling up your skull, and you herniate. Essentially, your brain gets squeezed out the bottom of your skull, and it gets destroyed, and then your brain dead. The story is that the Stefans were recently convicted of neglect for not taking their 19-month-old boy, Ezekiel, to medical attention until it was too late, resulting in his death. So they were convicted of failing to provide the basic essentials of life to their child. As it turns out, the father, David Stefan, runs essentially a supplement shop, the True Hope Nutritional Support Inc. So they're big believers in quote-unquote natural remedies. They're also anti-vaccinationists. They've completely drunk of the alternative medicine, natural medicine, Kool-Aid. Apparently, Ezekiel had never been to a doctor's appointment, like a well-child visit to a pediatrician.
Oof.
So he became sick 4 years ago, and they treated him with home remedies, and he didn't get better. So apparently, the mother talked about the case with a friend of hers who's a nurse. Still, you know, it's unclear what exactly the conversation was, whether or not she said this could be meningitis. You know, and what exactly she advised her to do. Apparently, the mother had looked up like how to treat meningitis online. That came out in the court case. At one point, they took him to a naturopath. The naturopath apparently sold them echinacea out of the office, but never laid eyes on Ezekiel. Never examined.
Whoa!
You know, this 19-year-old.
So did a remote analysis and prescribed medication, whatever. Prescribed something to cure this person without even seeing the quote-unquote patient.
Never laid eyes on Ezekiel. It was just like sold them echinacea out of their office, but it didn't treat it as like a patient visit.
And one more time, how old was Ezekiel?
19 months.
Oh,
19 months.
Sick.
So he continued to get worse. Strangely enough, the nutritional therapy, echinacea, and whatever roots they were giving him didn't work. It got to the point where he was so stiff, because the meningitis causes your neck and back to become stiff. He was so stiff, he couldn't sit in a car seat. They had to lay him down in the back seat of the car. And when he became almost unresponsive, then they rushed him to the hospital. And then there's, you know, debate about, you know, how responsive the ambulance was and did they have the right equipment or whatever. But he was essentially brain dead upon arrival to the hospital. They couldn't revive him. He was, I think, on a ventilator for 5 days before they decided to take him off, but he was basically brain dead. Yeah, horrible case. So the state took the parents to court for neglect, for allowing Ezekiel to die without providing him proper care. And it was just decided yesterday, as of this recording, the verdict came back guilty. They were found guilty.
And this was in Canada?
Yeah, this is in Canada. So,
do we know how our laws compare to Canadian laws?
They're not dramatically different.
Okay.
They're different in detail, but, you know.
But this could have happened here.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And it does.
Yeah. It does. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
I see this as no different than faith healing, right? Except their ideology was in nature as a, you know, instead of God, but otherwise it's pretty much the same.
Same idea.
So I agree with the verdict.
Oh, completely. As a parent, I am, you know, I hear about something changes when you have kids or, you know, you just have like a massive perspective change. And now, like, I hear this 19-month-old, you know, my daughter is 7 months old. I have a 3-year-old. Like, thinking about losing one of my children due to such painfully ridiculous neglect, it crushes me. Like, I hear that. And I'm like, this child would be happy and alive today if they literally went to the doctor for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And not to mention, I mean, aren't there meningitis vaccines?
For certain kinds, but probably not for what he had.
Gotcha.
Clearly, there's a lot of blame to go around here. The parents made a wrong call. They prioritized their ideology over the welfare of their child. Of course, you have to believe that they felt that they were doing the best and the right thing for their child. They were just massively misguided. But they don't have a right. And here's the thing, and this is what the court decided, and this is why I so agree with the decision, that, you know, as a parent, it's not about you. It's not about your beliefs. You don't have a right to impose them on your child. You still have to adhere to a quote-unquote standard of care. That was the what the prosecuting attorney, how he phrased it. And I completely agree with that. So that's why they are guilty. They neglected a basic standard of care of parents for their children. Now, their children – this is also based upon the notion that children aren't the property of the parents. They are the wards of the parents. They're also the wards of the state in a sense.
Partially,
the state has a responsibility for people who can't take care of themselves. They defer massively to parents – under the assumption that parents want to take care of their kids. And it's really very extreme cases like this. I wouldn't have been surprised if they were not convicted, but you know, I am glad that the jury brought back a guilty verdict here. So the parents still have the primary responsibility. I also think that the culture has a responsibility here because we have allowed this alternative medicine philosophy to blossom and flourish in our society. A generation ago, one generation ago, this kind of stuff would be called health fraud. Now it's alternative and it's accepted. Right. The state has a massive responsibility. They license naturopaths. It's an interesting wrinkle here that in the province where this happened, naturopaths were licensed after Ezekiel died. So we suspect that the naturopathic council won't do anything about this. They'll say, well, it was before our jurisdiction, you know, so we don't. But they probably wouldn't do anything anyway, to be honest with you.
That's an epic, ridiculous cop-out.
Well, the thing is, here's the thing. Naturopaths have no standard of care. There is no standard of care within the profession of naturopathy. They're not based upon science. Anything goes, as far as I could tell. They use homeopathy and acupuncture and any crazy thing they want, water cures and, you know, energy therapy and just all sorts of nonsense that are not based upon science. So how could you possibly have a standard of care?
Yeah.
You know?
It's interesting to think, Steve, that no naturopathic doctor is going to lay your judgment on another naturopathic doctor in a degree where they would be involved in saying that they did something wrong.
You can't, because then the whole house of cards collapses, right?
Yep.
How could you possibly say that treatment was not appropriate? By what standard? Okay, let's apply that same standard to all of naturopathy, and it's all not appropriate. None of it meets any science-based standard, you know? Yep. So, yeah, they can't afford to apply a standard to what they do. So they by definition and in practice, they don't have one. But the state licenses them, which legitimizes them. And so that might convince naive parents into thinking that it's appropriate to take a sick child to a naturopath. In fact, naturopaths in many states in the U.S. and in Canada are fighting to be treated, to be given the privileges of a primary care doctor, which is shocking. That is frightening. They are absolute quacks who shouldn't be practicing at all, let alone being the first point of contact for a sick patient. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Oof. Yeah, this case is a good case of why that would be a horrible, bad idea. You know, it's not like you could say this was an anomaly. No, this is what you. This is it. This is naturopathic care. This is the harm, right? When you ask the question, what's the harm? This is the harm. Yep. This is the result of being uncritical about unscientific beliefs, you know, about pseudoscience in medicine. This is, you know, the answer to every shruggy. It's like, you know, what's the harm? Let them have their magical therapies or whatever. No, this 19-month-old child who should be a perfectly happy, you know, healthy 6-year-old now, that's the harm. That's what happens when you treat magic as if it were legitimate medicine.
Yep.
So just, yeah, horribly tragic case. But the public has a short memory. I don't expect this is going to change the narrative. We try to use these cases, try to get something good out of them by saying, pointing out what led to these tragedies.
What's it going to take? I mean, do we need like a measles Disney level event for this type of specific situation where, oh yeah, we lost 10 kids last month because of this alternative medicine? What? I mean, this
probably
is such an obvious, it's in your face case. This 19-month-old kid died because of neglect, ideological neglect. What, if that doesn't do it, what is it going to take?
Bob, sadly, there's plenty of examples where, yes, the answer to your question is, yeah, it's going to take something much bigger than just one kid dying. You know,
sure.
That's it.
At the very least, you know, when we get a lot of emails here at SGU and, you know, from a lot of different perspectives, from a lot of different angles, talking about what we did last week, what we did that week, at the very least, I was taken aback by how we probably got at least, what would you say, 10, 15 emails specifically about this case?
Yeah, which is a lot.
It is in the consciousness. Yeah. Like, people are noticing it. And a lot of people wrote in to be like, you guys should cover this because this is a big deal. And that kind of gives me hope.
Yeah, although that's our audience.
Yeah,
that's
our audience.
It is our audience. Yeah. It's true. But, you know, to see the kind of camaraderie around that, something like this happens, and it is an outrage. And I think this is an extreme example. And so it can be a good teaching example because it's obvious to most anybody watching that this was a travesty.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that we need to focus on legislation because they are getting laws passed to eliminate the standard of care. You know, like healthcare freedom laws, that's what they're all about. They're making a lot of progress eliminating the standard of care because they can't adhere to it. We have to reverse that trend, but that means convincing scientifically illiterate legislators, unfortunately. And that's been a massively uphill battle.
Yeah.
We're
we're just holding the ocean back with a broom.
Yeah, basically. All right, Jay, get us up to date on Who's That Noisy.
Last week, guys, I played this sound.
30, 20, retard, 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 retard.
Okay, guys, what is it?
Recharge? Maybe he's saying recharge.
No, he's saying, retard. Like when
flame
retard. Like when you retard something,
oh, like
you
slow
hold
it down.
Back, slow it down.
Yeah.
James, is it like retard. Some space mission or something
similar? Yeah, close, but think a lot less dramatic.
An airplane?
Yeah, it's an airplane.
Ah.
It's a Airbus 319 series aircraft. So John Cole sent this one in to me, and John is actually a pilot of three different versions of the Airbus, 319, 320, and 321, and John said, the enclosed recording depicts the final seconds of the landing phase of an Airbus 319 series aircraft as heard from the flight deck. And then he goes into some technical stuff. The radar altimeter can be heard as if it counts down allowed certain preset altitude gates until at round out for final touchdown. This is pretty cool, right? At round out for final touchdown. The same synthesized voice reverts to repeatedly chanting the word retard. And it may sound stupid that the system feels it necessary to badger the human pilots about the perfectly obvious fact that the power should come to an idle at touchdown. So the plane is basically saying, slow the F down.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, I found that interesting. Like, I am a huge fan of, like, cockpit sounds and aircraft, spaceship sounds, and, you know, anything to do with, like, the mechanics and the engineering behind it and all that stuff is cool. And when I heard this, I thought it was odd. But what was even more odd was, wow, listeners, so many people knew what this was, and I had no clue what this was when I heard it. I got 50 emails of people dead on saying exactly what it is.
Wow.
Like, where
they hang out in cockpits in their spare time?
A couple of people, listeners of the show that we know very well, you know, I was like, how the hell did you know that? And, you know, it was varying degrees of answers. I was in one. I watched a TV show. There was a pretty funny
that's my voice on the recording.
Yeah, that's me. The winner this week is Michael Rops. Michael has been a listener for quite a while. Yeah. And I totally recognize his name and his picture with the email. He said, the countdown is the radar altitude above the ground. The retard is telling the pilot it's time to move the thrust levers to idle for landing. And he said, I believe it's an Airbus A320. Damn close enough. Okay. Thank you, Michael. Good guess. So that was it. So I appreciate John for sending that in. I have a new one this week. Steve,
yep,
you ready?
I'm ready. Hit me.
So that was sent in by a listener named Carrie Gale. Hey, Carrie, thank you so much for that. Very interesting. Couple of things in there, I think, that might stir something old in some of us that they may have heard long ago.
Yeah, I definitely recognize that.
Yep, you do. And when you hear it, you're going to go, okay. That's another thing that was just locked in my head.
Yeah.
And I'm not giving any more hints, but that when I heard it, I'm like, yep, I heard that before. And I had no idea where it was. And then when I read the answer, I'm like, okay, yeah, totally. So thank you, Carrie. And to everyone out there, please do continue. Guys, I'm getting a lot of really cool noisies, and it's fun for the show, and it's fun for me. So please do continue to send in any weird sounds you heard this week, and email me at WTN@theskepticsguide with your guests. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Jay. Okay, Kara, what's the word?
The word this week was actually recommended by a listener, and it is hyperthymesia, which is having a really efficacious autobiographical memory. So, of course, autobiographical memory is memory relating to your personal past. It can be both episodic and semantic, but it always involves the ability to recall specific situations, experiences, and for some people, even emotions in really vivid detail from any given calendar day. So you've probably heard of people who have hyperthymesia before, right? Can you guys think of any famous examples?
It's the gal from Taxi, right? What's her name? Mary Lou Henner?
Mary Lou Henner. Mary Lou Henner famously is said to have hyperthymesia. And another famous case in the clinical literature is that of A.J., who was extensively studied. She claims to be able to remember every single day of her life from the age of 14. And yet another more recent from the clinical literature is a patient named H.K., and he claims to have remembered every single day of his life since the age of 11. Now, although A.J.'s brain scans were relatively normal, HK's right amygdala was 20% larger than normal and appeared to have more connectivity to the hippocampus than matched controls in his
study.
Makes
sense.
Yeah, his brain was also, though, smaller, and he had several other anomalies because he was congenitally blind, and that seemed to have been secondary to a hemorrhagic stroke before birth, so he had cerebral palsy. It's also reported that people with hyperthymesia have cognitive limitations and burdens by this great amount of kind of resource that they have to dedicate to remembering. It's not to be confused, though, with people who have an intrinsic ability to calculate the calendar. You've probably known people where you're like, June 7th, 1962, and they're like, Tuesday.
That's a day-day calculation.
Yeah, that actually can occur in some types of savant syndrome, sometimes in individuals with very selective types of autism. This is not to be confused with that. These individuals more just hyper-remember almost every day of their life. They dedicate a lot of time to thinking about their past, and they dedicate a lot of time to recalling their past. And because of that, they actually have said that they struggle in other areas. And there's also some new research showing that hyperthymesic individuals have certain features in common with individuals who have been diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder. And now the etymology of the word comes from the Greek thymesis, meaning to remember, and of course, hyperthymesia.
Autobiographical memory is different than memory for other things. You know,
And I'm not good with that. I can't remember arguments that I had. I can't remember, I met you at that time. I'll be decades off from when things happened in my life. Like, oh, yeah, I met that
decades.
Guy.
Decades.
Oops. It's crazy. Yeah.
You have CRS syndrome.
What's that?
Can't remember shit.
That's so true.
Nice.
Love it.
Nice.
So what about false memories? Are these people susceptible to false memories the way, say, average people are?
That's an interesting question. And what's fascinating is the more that I read into this, the more I realized we know very little about these people because they are crazy rare. And it's hard to generalize anything that we know about one individual to other individuals. I am totally speaking out of turn saying that they would have to also have false memories the same way that we do, because we know that memory as an encoding process is not perfect. And we know that memories encode in, you know, we don't have a video camera in our brains. And we do make certain types of connections, and we do kind of, I would say, change our memories over time due to new experiences. So I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, individuals with hyperthymesia also have false memories. They just seem to have more of a vivid, kind of lucid memory, and specifically about personal experiences than the general population does.
We don't have to speculate. It's been studied. And in fact, people with hyperthymesia have the same false memory processes that people with regular memory do.
Mm. Oh, good.
Yeah, so they do. They do form, and every step of the way, they form false memories just like people without hyperthymesia do. All right. Well, thank you, Kara. That was a very, very interesting word this week.
Yeah.
Joining us now is Michael Whalen. Michael, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So for those in the audience who don't know, Michael Whalen is a famous science fiction artist. I've actually been a fan of your art since I was a child, really. But you live near us, you moved near us, and we became friends. And we wanted to have you on the show to talk up to as a follow-up to the discussion we had a couple of weeks ago about the computer, that algorithm that can create a essentially facsimile of a Rembrandt painting. I know that you're familiar with this.
Yeah.
Tell us what you think about that.
I think it's interesting technology. I have mixed feelings about it. I think that the video about it kind of hypes it a little more than I think it deserves to be. But a lot of people put a lot of hours into developing the software and the algorithms that enabled the whatever platform they used to create this image. And I think it's an interesting experiment, and it'll be fun to see where this technology leads art in the future. I have no doubt that there will be people who take this technology and use it to manipulate it and create original works rather than digital forgeries, which is basically what they've done with the Rembrandt. Who knows where we'll go from there. I know when I talk to collectors that the people who want to own original artwork, one thing they value about original artwork is having a feeling that they're able to see the hand of the artist, so to speak, in the paint, in the application of the paint on the canvas. Whereas with a digital print, you don't see that. It's perfectly flat. I think one of the most interesting aspects of the technology that they use in this process that was explained in the video is developing a way of simulating the actual movement and shape of brush strokes in the application of the digital inks on the canvas, so that when you hold it up to the light look at it at an angle, so that you see the highlights across the image area, you see what appears to be actual brush strokes of paint on the canvas. So I imagine to hold the painting and see it with the naked eye, it's probably indistinguishable from an original painting. And that's pretty interesting.
I am both utterly fascinated by this, right? It's just amazing what they did with this, with that Rembrandt, that next Rembrandt software, and what it actually did. The next Rembrandt project essentially quantified Rembrandt's style. And then when they were done developing the software, they told the software, make us a painting of a 30 to 40 year old male with facial hair facing to the right with a white collar and dark clothing. And it painted a painting that is, it's original in the sense that Rembrandt never painted this painting, but it is completely in Rembrandt's hand and style. When you look at it, it's a Rembrandt. It looks like he painted it. So they did give it parameters, but I believe the software just did a remarkable job of quantifying Rembrandt's style, and then 3D printing at the very end, they 3D printed actually brush strokes and everything, and like Michael was describing. I have a visceral problem with this in a sense, because there's something to me that is so human. And now I don't care if it's digital or hand painted or whatever. I don't care what the medium is, but it really is like a very intimate and romantic relationship that I have in my head with an artist and their medium and the artwork that they produce. You know, even with you, like I like, you know, I've seen you work, and I like having that vision in my head of you in your studio doing the process of what you do. And the other thing that bothers me, and just, you know, give me a reaction to these 2 points. The other thing is that I know that you spent the vast majority of your life honing your brand. You developed your style, you became very good at it, and you own it in a sense, right? You do. I mean, someone just can't come out and start copying your artwork without there being trouble behind that. A human would take a week or a month to make a Michael Whalen knockoff, or longer, and now this software, if they use this software to create your style, to duplicate your style, they could potentially do a Michael Whalen painting in an hour.
I have mixed feelings about it. I don't feel threatened by it at all. I enjoy digital technology and embrace the use of digital tools even in my own workflow, and I find them very helpful. I think if Leonardo or Rembrandt were living today, they'd be using digital technology to enhance whatever natural gifts nature gave them in terms of their vision and capabilities as artists.
Mm-hmm.
only a tool after all.
Yeah,
that was kind of my reaction, was that this is a tool. And that how you get from something in your head, an idea in your head, an image or whatever, to the final product doesn't really determine whether it's art or what the artistic content is. It's the creativity, the composition, the what you're expressing. So, and I think that as technology has progressed, it is increasingly separating the technical aspects of being able to physically create the art from the creative aspect of just like composing and imagining the art. So I did want to ask you how you feel about that. Like, how much do you feel that your technical skill is part of the creative process, is part of your artistic process? And do you feel something would be lost if essentially no technical skill was required, that anybody could bring their imagination to life through this kind, you know, a mature version of this kind of technology?
Well, the same kind of arguments were in the air when photography was invented. There were people that said that once photography became freely available, they said this was going to be the death of painting, and no one's going to want to buy a painting anymore because we can take a picture. You know, we have photography, but, you know, there are still corporate CEOs that are having their portraits painted by master oil painters today, you know, because that's considered to be more valuable or have a higher snob appeal than just blowing up a big photograph of the person and putting that in a frame. There's something special about an artist interpreting and creating a, you know, an image of a person. So I think a lot about when it's funny how I always think of ways in which music is analogous to what I see happening in the visual arts. And I remember back in the 80s when a lot of synth pop was being produced. There was an article in the Rolling Stone magazine where they predicted, but you know, within 10 years that bands wouldn't have drummers anymore because drum machines were so good. That there's plenty of drummers still working, and there's just nothing like hearing a real live drummer. I don't care how sophisticated and how good your drum machines are, that just doesn't have the same appeal as seeing a person create that. And I think that's true of painting.
Yeah. I mean, but although I have to say that's because you can hear the difference between even the best drum machines even today and a real live drummer, but that's probably not going to be true forever. And, you know, when it's like we're kind of in the uncanny valley with drumming, you know, where it's pretty.
It's like too perfect.
Yeah, it's too perfect. And so it doesn't feel real. And there's nuances to the drumming that's missing. But, you know, there's no reason why a computer algorithm can't duplicate Rush or whatever, you know, like the, you know, Stuart Copeland, you know, completely duplicate the feel of his drumming and the nuance and the imperfections to make it indistinguishable. And I got to believe that's what they're going to be doing in the studio once computers get to
that
point.
That's a good point, Steve. Like, I get that. I get, like, there's two sides to this coin. Like, there's something really cool about putting that level of talent, in a sense, in the hands of people that don't have it so they can write music and levels that they wouldn't normally be able to do, right? I get that. Or, you know, I have a cool idea for a painting. I can't draw a straight line with a ruler, but I'm going to use this software to bring my vision to a visual reality, right?
You can take a photograph and run a Photoshop filter over it that'll make it look like a watercolor painting.
Yeah.
And say, I created this watercolor painting.
But okay. So here's my question to everyone. Is there a difference between me doing what Michael just described and me actually painting the watercolor? Is there a sense more of, in a way, you know, I'm using that word loosely right now, but is there more agency to something that was truly hand-created versus something that was spit out by a 3D printer?
Or is there more artistic value, or is it irrelevant?
Yeah, I'm just curious. I mean, I'm turning this over in my head right now, trying to figure out whether or not I have a valid point.
I mean, my, I guess, initial gut reaction would be, isn't that what's up to the patrons? Isn't that up to the critics? So I think your question is a photograph that has a filter over it that looks like a watercolor versus a real watercolor. Is there something more artistically valuable about that? Well, I would rather have, you know, if it was a really interesting artist that I loved, I would rather have his photoshopped watercolor than like somebody who's, I'm not, it's not my taste, having done a real watercolor.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's definitely related to the artist, because it, I mean, I was thinking, would you rather have a wood carving that your dad made for you, you know, that you spend hours or days carving this wood, or, you know, what if he just ran, you know, like a plastic that looks like wood into a mold and then popped it out? That effort and talent that went specifically into the creation, it just adds something that I think
but it's
going to be hard.
I think it's overrated. That's all romantic. That does remind me of the time we were.
I agree.
Here's my anecdote. We were at a Ren Fair and we were admiring this wool, whatever, pullover. And I asked the woman how much it cost. She said 2,000. I was like, what, 2,000 quatlus? Because, like, really, you're going to, honestly, you're charging $2,000 for that, for a wool sweater, basically. So then she describes the painstaking process she went through to make it. I raised the sheep myself and sheared the sheep, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I don't care.
Right. That's right.
Steve, you are so mean.
No, sure. That's why people don't do it that way anymore. You know,
because they can't make a living at it.
Because I'm not going to pay $2,000 for a $50 sweater because you had to go through all the trouble to raise your own sheep. That's irrelevant to me as the end user. I think
if it's an item that's got no personality, you know, no personal feeling in it, then you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. What's the point?
But for something, yeah, well, I think Bob, you're talking about sentimental value.
Yes,
but that's a separate issue entirely.
It is. It is. It's a subset.
Getting back to the Rembrandt, I think that digital print, if it was put in the sun, would probably fade a lot faster than a real Rembrandt.
Interesting.
I'm not sure that the digital print would last like an actual painting would.
But let's not miss the hypothetical question here is, what if the technology gets to the point where there isn't a physical difference?
Yeah.
Like we talked about with the drum machine. What about when drum machines are there? What about when this technique is there? Jay, I remember you having a conversation with George Traub about instruments. Like, you used to have to spend $5,000 to get a good sounding guitar. Now the manufacturing technology is such that you can get a great sounding guitar for $500.
Yeah.
And because the technology is just there. It doesn't have to be handcrafted anymore because the machine crafted or the technology is so good. So we will get to the point where those computer 3D printed whatever algorithm driven knockoffs are of the same physical quality in every way.
Yep.
And then it erases the value of the labor and the technical skill and all
that. I know, Steve, I don't deny any of that.
Yeah, you'll still see those collectors.
Yeah, I don't deny it. I'm really taking this from like my respect and adoration in a sense of highly skilled, super talented people who have actually chosen the right, like, you know, like you think of Michael's talent, and
I really admire the medieval illuminators who would spend months writing a letter in a book, but no one is going to do that anymore.
You're just a mean person. Do you know this?
Yes, Steve. So insensitive.
Michael, let me ask you a question.
Sure.
You do the labor of the paintings. And we've had many conversations with you where you're just exhausted and your hands are cramping up. And it's really physically brutal on you physically to do paintings. What if you could, you know, sketch out your art idea, your painting idea, put it into a computer, and then have a computer do all of the technical grunt work? You would do that in a minute, wouldn't you?
I would, in a New York minute. Yeah, it'd be awesome. Yes. I don't assign any particular value to how the image gets done, as long as it gets done. But I do say I enjoy playing with paints and splashing paint around in my studio, and I would miss... I can tell the difference in how I feel at the end of the day between a day I spent drawing on the computer and a day I spent working up in my regular studio, standing at an easel or working at a drawing table. It's a whole different experience. The only thing I've moved all day long is my right arm from my elbow to my fingertips. And the rest of my body has been fairly static during most of the process. And with the other thing, it's a whole body movement, and I feel that much more engaged with the materials. And when I'm working digitally, there's very little opportunity for accidents to happen. You know, it'd be kind of fun, actually, if someone would invent software that just randomly inserted glitches into digital images that artists are working on so that it made accidental things happen that you had to contend with. Because that's what happens when I'm working upstairs, you know, on a painting on my easel. A splash of paint will happen, or there'll be a drip or something. And sometimes it's a fortuitous accident. I'll look at it and I'll say, that makes it actually better. Or, you know, this could be a tentacle coming down here and da-da-da-da-da. And wow. It'll lead me off on a tangency that wouldn't have occurred to me otherwise. When I'm working digitally, you know, there's no opportunity for that to happen, really. I remember an interview with Brian Eno in Wired magazine, and he said that he was bothered by digital keyboards, the current generations of digital keyboards, because he said they were too good, that they gave you too many options, that you could do virtually anything with that. And his feeling was that art happens in artists trying to work around the obstacles that are built into the technology that he's dealing with, that he's trying to create art with. And if there are limitations in a keyboard or in a sound module or in a guitar or something that one is working with, you have to develop creative ways to work around those limitations, and that leads you into a unique sound or a unique solution to the problem that makes the art yours and distinctive and different from what other people would do. And the same is true with the visual arts. You know, I've got different ways of creating an image on a canvas or on a panel or whatever, and I try to vary my approach as often as possible, just to keep myself interested and to allow for accidents and variables to get inserted into my process so that my work goes in directions that I don't necessarily anticipate right from the beginning. That there's less opportunity for that to happen when I'm working digitally. I love what digital tools can do, don't get me wrong, but I tend to use digital software for the initial stages of doing layouts, testing different color schemes, especially perspective layouts. Oh my God, you can create vanishing points on horizon lines that go, you know, miles out to one side or the other, whereas if I was trying to plot that out on the floor of my studio, you know, I'd have to build an annex onto one side to have the vanishing point go far enough to allow me to you know, use an analog method of creating the perspective line. So it's a great tool.
Yeah, I could see that. And that was one of the questions I had, is like, what is the value of the process and how does that contribute to the creative or the artistic process? But you could also argue, if I'm playing devil's advocate, that mm-hmm. the new technology just has new opportunities. It doesn't have the same old opportunities. Like you might say, well, if you're taking if you're taking a picture, you know, that you lose a lot of the creative aspect of painting. It's like, yeah, but there's lots of new opportunities with photography that.
Oh my goodness, you're so right. I've been a judge for, there's an annual that comes out once a year, and it's been coming out now for 22, 23, 25 years. I can't remember how long we've been doing it, but it's called the Spectrum Fantasy Art Annual, and it's the best fantasy art produced every year, and there's a panel of judges that are selected to judge the work. And I was a judge in the first Spectrum Annual many years ago, and the 10th, and I believe the 20th. And the difference from the first to the 20th is a quantum expansion in the quantity and the quality of the digital art being done.
Yeah.
I saw, you know, now a good deal of the work being done for Hollywood, for example, and whatever is all done digitally. And it's not just that it's painted digitally, you know, using a tablet on a screen or whatever, but they're making use of digital tools that allow for techniques that simply aren't available to a traditional painter. So it's quite a wonderful thing, and the artists that are skilled in fully employing what's available digitally are really creating things that no one's ever seen before, and they're wonderful.
Yeah,
it's a very exciting development.
What generally happens is when a new technology comes along, it is used to replace the old technology, but mm-hmm. then eventually it evolves into a thing unto itself. You know, like first cars were literally horseless carriages, then they evolved into cars, you know, their own thing. And it's the same thing, like we're using digital technology to duplicate analog technology when in fact it will take on a life of its own and open up possibilities that just weren't possible with analog.
That's exactly
technology.
True. I've seen that actually happen. If I can give you a short anecdote, I delivered a painting for a cover for a Stephen King book in 1988 to a publisher, and the art director said, well, enjoy this while you can. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I figure in 5 years, guys like you are going to be obsolete. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, we'll develop banks of image files, and after a while, we'll be able to just digitally combine images of different objects and combine them in such a way as to make an effective book cover, and we won't need guys like you anymore to do our book covers for us. And I said, well, most of what I do is fantasy art, so when you can find photographs of dragons, I'll start to worry about it. But the thing is, if you've seen Reign of Fire or The Hobbit or whatever, they can do dragons now.
Yes, they can.
I mean, it's amazing. You know, so, you know, I'm having to eat my own words in a funny kind of way. You know, I thought I was being a smartass back then in 1988, but now... oh my God! The things that can be created digitally are just mind-boggling. So, and there will come a time, I think, Steve, in the future, where you'll have AI programs that actually can make the editing decisions that particular artists would choose to select. You know, in the creation and.
Yeah.
Actually, not just simulate a Rembrandt or create a Rembrandt forgery that fits a narrow spectrum of parameters. You know, a figure that's a portrait, a male facing right wearing dark clothing, but actually be able to create a Rembrandt of virtually any subject matter that would have been available to Rembrandt during his lifetime. You know, I think that's only a matter of time before we get to a point where we can develop a technology that can do that. And I don't think I'll be around when that happens, so I'm not worried too much about it, but I'm glad I'm not a young artist just starting out.
So, Michael, are you saying that you welcome our robotic overlords?
Yeah, sure.
Well, okay, so, I mean, this is interesting when you think about the massive pluses and maybe not so massive minuses as I originally thought. But yeah, the pluses are profound. You know, I think without a doubt, the future is going to have some profound artwork and the ability for people. When I mean profound artwork, I mean there's going to be a lot of original artwork because of how easy it's going to be for people to create incredible pieces of art just from them, maybe even doing a rough sketch on a, you know, some type of tablet. It'll be rendered by the software.
Oh, goodness. I've seen exhibits of sketches done all on iPhones, you know, at the Society of Illustrators. And it's amazing what people can do with the tools. If they're used to them, if they've grown up with them, they're comfortable with them, and they become really skilled with a particular software platform. You know, it's the creativity of the human mind is almost endless. And as digital technology progresses, I think human creativity will move along with it and make use of these new tools in ways that we can't even envision. But I think it'll continue to be interesting. I don't think humans will be made obsolete. We'll just have a new set of tools in our toolbox to make more interesting and more relevant contemporary artwork.
Well, Michael, this has been a fascinating discussion. Thanks so much for joining us. For those of you who aren't familiar with his work, it's Whelan. Just look up Michael Whelan. If you are a science fiction or fantasy fan, you're almost certain to recognize much of his artwork on your favorite novels. Really, I think this is a very fascinating idea. It gets to the core of like what is art and the relationship, you know, between technology and the expression of art. I think it's fascinating. So thanks for joining us.
Well, my pleasure. It's been a real fun time, and I've been a fan of the podcast for quite a long time, so I feel honored to be part of it.
Oh, thanks. It's great to have
thanks,
you.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Thank Michael.
All right, take
Thank
care.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items, or facts, two real and one fake. I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. No theme this week, just three interesting news items. You guys ready?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, item number one. Researchers find that assisted driving systems that use a more natural voice, especially one that the driver socially connects to, result in decreased accidents. Item number two, scientists have created an artificial protein that self-assembles with Buckminster fullerenes to create a lattice superstructure. And item number three, scientists have developed an entirely dissolvable memristor that can potentially be used as an implantable or environmentally safe sensor.
What is that word that you said?
Isn't it it's a new fundamental component of computing, like AND gates and AND gates?
It's like RAM and a resistor at the same time.
Oh, that makes more sense. You said, Bob, just made it more confusing.
Okay.
Oh, that's also the memristors are more neurological. Like they mimic brain function better. Jay, go first.
Okay, this first item about the, if I'm hearing this correctly, so you have an assisted driving system. Steve, is that GPS? Just give it to me.
No, it's like a computer that says... That tells you, helps you drive.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm just trying, I don't know what the difference is between an assisted driving system. Is that like in a self-driving car?
Yeah, it's like pseudo self-driving, but it's assisting the driver.
Gotcha. Okay. But it's, you know, slow down, turn left here type thing.
Yeah.
Okay. It's saying that if the system uses a more natural voice, one that the driver socially connects to, I think that's the key phrase, the one that the driver socially connects to, results in decreased accidents. So I could see it going both ways. I could see if it's something that's a little bit foreign to the driver, that they'd pay closer attention to it because they have to. And then if it's something that they are more comfortable with, they'd pay more attention to it. So yeah, I could see this going either way. I will hold that for a second. The second one here about the artificial protein self-assembling, I believe it. I have no reason to cut that one apart. Seems perfectly legit.
Really?
To create, I don't know what a Buckminster Fullerene or Renery or is.
We talked
about
like last
Buckyballs.
All right. I know what Buckyballs are. So the Buckminster, Bucky. Okay. All right. This last one is interesting. You have like this memristor dissolvable component that can be implanted. I mean, it sounds like there's a lot going on there, but for some reason, I feel like, you know, yeah, we're developing stuff like this now. So let's see. Yeah, the second one about the self-assembling buckyball, that is pretty serious, man. That's pretty serious. All right, I'm going to say that number two is the fiction, the one about the buckyballs.
Okay, Kara?
I never know how to answer because I'm always looking for the tricks. If I'm going to go with my gut here, I would say that I would fully agree with Jay about the assisted driving systems, that it could go both ways. You might trust somebody who has a voice that you socially connect to more, and that might result in decreased accidents, or a completely novel voice might kind of whip you into shape. You know, you might respond to it more and pay more attention. The problem with that hypothesis is that it won't be novel once you do it for a week. So hopefully if that is the case, they would have looked past that. So I'm going to go ahead and say that it is factual that assisted driving systems that use a more natural voice would result in decreased accidents. Scientists having created artificial proteins using buckyballs to create a lattice superstructure sounds totally reasonable to me. The one that sounds unreasonable to me is the memristor one. And it's only because I don't understand how, if something can completely dissolve, how it can be functional anymore. I mean, I don't know. For me, the definition of something dissolving is that it goes down to component molecules, that actually the bonds start to break in these individual component or even.
Well,
yeah,
I'll clarify for you that
gotcha.
It doesn't work after it dissolves, right?
It's
like it works until it dissolves. It's a way of like
that really helps. That helps. That's
Kara
huge.
Has a huge love and respect for technology, Steve.
That is hilarious.
No, that was like, going to be my question.
Really? Why you would want to dissolve okay. memories?
I didn't even anticipate that interpretation.
Gotcha.
It's like so the idea would be that. Like, yeah, we put the memristor in your body. And it works and does its job, and then it dissolves, so we don't have to take it out.
And then it dissolves, yeah. And so I'm thinking that if your body doesn't dissolve it, what would the environment do to dissolve it? So I don't know about the idea of like it being so selective yet that it can exist in your body where you have all these different pH shifts and you know, depending on the compartment, or you have all these different types of moisture, different salt concentrations, and then somehow it would dissolve in the ocean or in your toilet. So I'm gonna still say that this one strikes me as being complicated, and I fear what I don't understand. So I'm gonna go with the memristors that are dissolvable being the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, I could see problems with all of these. The driving one, yeah, on one hand, a voice that's more familiar in a lot of ways. I could see that perhaps being effective. But then I could also see you just, you know, people are talking in the car all the time and you ignore that. It wouldn't like get your attention like a robotic voice. Like, oh, that, you know, that's clearly not human. I want to listen to that type of thing. So that one, I'm not sure. The Buckminster Fullerenes, that I have a problem with that is because, protein self-assembly. I mean, we haven't cracked that damn nut. I mean, we still don't know, precisely how a given protein is going to fold. It's just way too complicated, to predict even with a supercomputer at this point in a lot of ways. So I've got a problem with that one. And then the dissolvable memristor. I mean, I would think there'd be some components in there. I mean, how would they get that would not easily dissolve? So I may just like flip a coin on this one. Now I'm going to go with the self-assembly. I just think we just can't control that in a way that seems like it might be required to get it to integrate with a Buckminster Fullerene. Yeah.
Okay.
Fiction.
Okay, and Evan.
Well, Bob, you sort of took the words right out of my mouth. I didn't think that self-assembly with these things was here yet. Artificial protein that self-assembles. Boy, wouldn't that mean we could control a lot of other things and how proteins assemble? And that, you know, like you said, Bob, that's the nut that we've yet to crack. I think you're right. I think that one's going to turn out to be the fiction. The other ones are interesting and... you know, in their own right, but this one I think is going to be the fiction.
Okay, so it's Bob and Evan with the Buckminster Fullerenes and
Jay.
And Jay. I'm the standalone.
So it's Bob, Evan, and Jay with the Fullerenes and Kara by herself with the memristor. Okay, so you all agree on the first one, so we'll start there. Researchers find that assisted driving systems that use a more natural voice, especially one that the driver socially connects to, results in decreased accidents. You all think this one is science, and this one is the fiction.
No!
Oh, mother...
What?
Wow.
Another sweep!
Wow.
No
come wow. on.
You're messing
totally
with
got
us.
Me.
No, totally I believe it. Yes. I believe it too.
Yeah, you could, wow. like you guys could kind of go both ways. It's the other way. Yeah. So it actually increased accidents. It increased accidents. So strong interactions with voice guided vehicles do not result in safer driving. They had drivers in a simulated, you know, driving using Oculus Rift actually. And, they gave the user the option of choosing like the voice that the computer would have that they would be interacting with. And if you could either choose a very similar voice or a dissimilar voice. And in fact, the more human-like and the more friendly and also the more socially similar to the person, the driver, the higher the crash rate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
They crashed more during the simulation. So not clear why that is. It's interesting. You know, it's just, again, it's one study. It takes multiple studies to try to wrap your head around these kind of behavioral things. But it's interesting. I would think it has something to do with distraction. Like there's something more engaging about the voice, which is distracting you from the task of driving. So, but that, you know, that we need some follow up to figure out exactly what's going on there. So we have to think very carefully when we start to get to quasi-autonomous cars, right? autonomous cars that are, you're still a driver, but they're helping you drive. They might be doing some collision avoidance or braking or giving you some instructions or whatever. Every time we add a gadget to the car, there is the potential that it could have an unintended consequence of distracting the driver and increasing accidents. So you have to be very careful about that. But it could be something as simple as having a voice that doesn't engage you emotionally or socially or whatever. Interesting. Okay, let's move. So, of course, the other two are science, but let's move on to number two. Scientists have created an artificial protein that self-assembles with Buckminster Fullerenes to create a lattice superstructure. That is science. This is cool. This is a very cool proof of concept here. The researchers at the Dartmouth College and their collaborators created an artificial protein. When this artificial protein is exposed to the Buckminster Fullerenes, which are basically 60 carbon atoms connected up in the shape of a soccer ball, that they self-assembled, so it's the proteins and the buckyballs together, right? That's why I said it self-assembles with the buckyballs to form this lattice structure. So this is obviously like just a proof of concept kind of study, but it demonstrates the potential of using these kind of engineered proteins in order to create desirable structures out of nanomaterials like buckyballs, right? So if we could, and we could create, we could have things self-assemble, imagining, you know, having the, at least like the components of, you know, computer equipment self-assembling out of whatever, carbon nanotubes or nanofibers, or in this case, buckyballs, just by mixing it with the proper protein. You could also, theoretically, once it does self-assemble, you could dissolve away the protein if you don't want that to be part of the final product, or you might want it to be part of the final product. You know what I mean? No reason why the protein itself can't be part of what you're going for. So this, you know, the self-assembling nanomaterials obviously is a huge area of research.
Sure.
So, yeah. I mean, the potential there is massive, you know, just mixing stuff together and it building the structures that you want. You might just choose the protein that you want, mix it up with whatever the other raw material is, and boom, there you go. You got your...
Boom, huh? Is that the noise it makes?
Yeah.
So, does it produce light when it happens, Steve?
There's a flash and a boom, and then zip.
Yeah, it's like, imagine you got a bunch of Legos, you put them in a bag together, and they self-assemble into a little tiny Millennium Falcon. I mean, that's what's basically happening down there, and it's really cool if they could leverage that natural ability. Damn, that'd be awesome.
Yeah. All right. This means that scientists have developed an entirely dissolvable memristor that can potentially be used as an implantable or environmentally safe sensor is also science. And yeah, memristors themselves are cool. They're resistors that also remember their electrical state, so they have memory as well. And these researchers built a memristor out of components that dissolve when wet, but when dry will function. So it was made out of spun out of diluted egg albumin on a silicon wafer and then turned into an ultra-thin film. And then they incorporated electrodes made out of magnesium and tungsten. They tested the device in a dry condition in the lab, and it worked reliably for 3 months. And then they put it in water, and it dissolved between 2 and 10 hours.
Wow.
Hmm.
So the like albumin parts of it dissolved in a number of hours, 2 to 10 hours, and then the metal parts dissolved in about 3 days, leaving behind just minimal residue, they said. So the application of this, why would you bother to build dissolvable, you know, memristors, is for like implantation into an animal, or if you need to place them in the environment and you only need them to function for a short period of time, but you want them to eventually go away, you know, you won't have to go back and collect them. This option could be useful. It's like, you know, you could think about it like dissolvable stitches, right? You know, you put this when you're like sewing deep, putting deep stitches in a wound, you can't go back in there and take them out. You want them just dissolve on their own. But they last long enough for the wound to heal. And then after the wound heals, the stitches just dissolve. This would be the same thing. So yeah, it's a very interesting idea. Again, it's one of those things that kind of technology, it's always hard to know how it's going to play out, who's going to find a use for it. Is there going to be a quote unquote killer app, or is it just going to be a laboratory curiosity?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Tricky. Yes, which means Steve wins.
Yeah. Well, you guys swept me last week.
Oh. Sweep.
Yep. And then
I don't remember because I have such a bad memory.
Yeah. A bad autobiography.
CRS.
You guys never heard that one, huh?
I did, but I forgot.
Yeah. Is this something with Kara Santa Maria? What is it?
Awesome.
Or what are you going for here?
I thought it was a medical thing. You know?
Yeah, that's what I was hoping you were going to think. All right, Evan, speaking of medical things, give us the quote for this week.
The claim of alternative practitioners to not treat disease labels, but the whole patient, allows alternative practitioners to live in a fool's paradise of quackery where they believe themselves to be protected from any challenges and demands for evidence. Damn right. And that was said by Edzard Ernst, friend of skeptics everywhere, German-born, but a physician in the UK, and researcher specializing in the study of complementary and alternative medicine. He's been seen as, quote, the scourge of alternative medicine for publishing critical research that exposes methods that lack documentation of efficacy. And the 2015 John Maddox Prize award winner for his courage in standing up for science. Good man, Edzard.
I like that name.
Edzard, yeah. He's awesome. Cool name. He basically started out. He was a trained homeopath, but if it's also a physician, and he said he wanted to bring scientific rigor to the field of alternative medicine. He was actually a proponent, but then over the years, he said, the evidence shows that none of it works. And then not only does it not work, but the proponents, he said alternative medicine proponents are children. It's like they whine and complain when you show them evidence. It's like, this quote, I could see, him in this quote, why he said this, that they live in this fool's paradise where they think that because they ideologically have framed their practices in such a way, they're immune to evidence. That's because they don't want to be held to the standards of evidence. He totally, learned that firsthand from within the community. He was within the community to start.
That's right.
But, just.
And very brave of him to break out from within, from his roots, basically, from where he came.
He listened to the evidence,
Yeah.
As a good scientist does.
Yep, absolutely. All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.